In a time before the white man came to what is now the Midwest, many tribes inhabited this land. They had villages and traded and hunted. They raised families and built societies based on the traditions handed down from their ancestors. Then came the settlers from Europe. They came by boat and by land. They were expanding their reach from the East Coast, and they wanted to raise their families and build their own societies in a land that belonged to someone else.
But they found themselves being pushed by the settlement of the Europeans and Euro-Americans, pushed west.
Occupying the same space seemed impossible.
There were little splinter groups that stayed and just assimilated into the culture.
And so the settlers advanced and spread their way onto the prairies and into the hills, along the rivers and the great expanses.
When they were forced out of Ohio, as Ohio began to take this land through treaty, they were pushed out of Ohio and into Indiana.
Then came the conflict.
And Little Turtle made it very clear that Indiana was, and as far east as the Columbus, Ohio, was Miami territory.
Each side felt entitled, one by their desire and the other by their birthright.
The breach of trust is that the Delawares were living on in Indiana, were living on lands that had been given to them by the Miami.
You know, there were treaties that were made with these indigenous nations, but they were, no sooner were they made, that they were kind of broken.
The conflict would not last decades, but for centuries.
And of course, that treaty led to their removal to Indian territory.
Leaving the society that was built over both sides of the fight to both deride and honor the native peoples who were eventually scattered forcibly, some into oblivion.
We've still got, you know, the mascots here in the state of Indiana. I think we've got squaws used a couple of times. We've got redskins right down here in downtown.
The Miami Nation of Indians of Indiana is very proud that this is called the Land of Indians. They really like that.
I think through the years we've tried to be conscious of doing things the right way and respectfully.
Both young and old alike go over there to absorb what the Native Americans bring here.
Now you get to travel.
There is a high respect, as I see it.
And listen.
There's a lot of things that history's done to demean the Native American people.
And learn in the country that came to be called Indiana, Land of Indians.
If you change the name of a city, whether it's Indianapolis or another city, someone has to sweep through all of those entries in our state statute and find them and then change them.
January 2021.
Indianapolis is an international designation. I mean, the question was, does it make sense, not only for Indianapolis, but for other cities to use a 500-person petition to do that?
In the Indiana State Legislature, a bill was introduced that would keep some names from being changed, the names of cities like Indianapolis. The implication was that some people might feel that the Indian in Indianapolis was offensive. You'll now hear that notion explored. But with it comes the exploration of the society that came before this one, which is being honored, or not, by names like Anderson, Muncie, Miami, and Delaware counties. Those places are named for American Indians that inhabited Indiana. But teams with names like the Redskins or the Indians may provide feelings of angst or resentment, even if it's unintended, among the people who once held domain over Indiana. While the history of the people called Indians dates back much further than white people or black people or anyone else in this country, as a whole, they have not always been afforded respect. The term Indian itself is used loosely, applied as a monolith, a single name for a people with varied histories, ancestries, geographic origins, and genetic backgrounds.
It's a delicate thing, who we call ourselves. Even a lot of non-Indian groups, ethnic groups, like to have certain names, and those names can change over time, too.
Historian Stuart Rayford. It's not only the names that change over time, but the perception, and in media, the level of respect. American Indians in the early days of film were many times portrayed as evil, the bad guy, the foil to cowboys. But not always. The relationship of film to Native people has been dynamic, with negative stereotypes ever present.
I didn't mean to shoot him. I didn't want to hurt him.
Take it easy, son. How is he, Tonto?
Him dead, Kimasabe.
Dead!
But also with recognition to varying degrees over time of the humanity within Native tribes.
Ethan, you figure they'll charge us?
You asking me?
I am.
Thank you.
In John Ford's The Searchers, starring John Wayne, the Native tribes were portrayed as savages, slaughtering white pioneers mercilessly and holding children captive into adulthood. The movie can be seen as one-sided.
Yep. Death song. War chief, he's got it a safe face. Yes, sir, he'll be right in your lap in a minute, sonny.
Though it does paint a stark picture of some of the realities of pioneer life in the West and the conflict that existed sometimes between natives and settlers.
Now, John, those coins were part of a federal shipment that was lost between here and Pueblo. You think I stole it?
A decade later, Gunsmoke varied in its portrayals of Native people, but offered some obvious attempts to reconcile the image with episodes like The Treasure of John Walking Fox, guest starring Leonard Nimoy as an educated, world-wise American Indian.
Suppose I were to say I found them on the prairie, just the two of them. Did you? Or that they were given to me by an elder of the tribe as talismans to ward off evil. Is that what you're saying? I haven't said anything. And I haven't done anything but spend two coins that belong to me.
But therein was the problem. A white Jewish man portrayed the American Indian character, what some people would later call cultural appropriation, and minus one job for a Native American actor.
Oh, hurt my mules.
Dances with Wolves offered what some people considered a more authentic portrayal of not only Native Americans, but of the relationships between the Sioux tribe and settlers, and clear delineations between the tribes portrayed in the 1991 film.
Tatanka. Tatanka.
Tatanka. Buffalo.
And out of the American Indian activism in the last quarter of the 20th century and into the 21st came an awareness that media creations and team nicknames could stand some scrutiny, and some of them might not bear up. Coming up, getting acquainted with the Indians of Indiana. You're listening to Indiana, Land of Indians. You're listening to Indiana, Land of Indians. What you're hearing is a contemporary rendition of music from the Sagamore tribe.
Most of the people probably don't know that history that go to the powwow. They don't know, they don't teach it in schools here, so they don't know that history. So their sense of the Native Americans that come here is really not fostered by any historical information they have about them.
Madison County historian Steve Jackson talking about the people who come to the Anderson powwow.
They just come, some out of curiosity, surely, but others out of something they do every year. It's grandparents bringing their grandchildren. It's a way to introduce them to a culture that no longer exists in this area. And it's a way to expose. I've taken my granddaughters there. I want them to see that. I want them to feel it. I want them to experience it. That's part of life.
And if you don't know the history of American Indians in Indiana, Madison McGill and three historians get you up to speed.
The first chapter of Indiana's history doesn't start in 1816, when it became a state. It begins with the people that were here before pioneers even broke ground on the land. Oh, yeah. Native American tribes like the Miami, Potawatomi, and Shawnee called the lands of Indiana their home.
They were the first occupiers and long-term occupiers of this land.
Andy Olson, who researched and wrote a four-part series, The 1818 St. Mary's Treaties, for the Indiana Historical Society. Dr. Stuart Rayford studies Native communities and co-wrote the book, The Native Americans. He says Native American tribes have always been moving, following the game, making Indiana, in a sense, a crossroads.
Even before the outsiders came in, Indians were moving back and forth across the area of Indiana.
One of the most prominent tribes in the area, says Rayford, especially after the Beaver Wars in the 1700s, was the Miami, led by Chief Little Turtle.
And Little Turtle made it very clear that Indiana was, and as far east as the Columbus, Ohio, was Miami territory. And that really set things up for the Miami to assert themselves in Indiana, because that goes back to Little Turtle, that this is our territory. Other tribes are here by our invitation.
Then European settlements began to pop up along the East Coast, pushing the native tribes farther west off their lands. Madison County historian Steve Jackson.
Indians didn't own ground. They never had title to them. They just claimed title to them, and that's where they hunted. And so it was never like today, you have deeds and clear titles. None of that. There was no paperwork. It was just their claim.
One of the tribes, the Delaware, would end up relocating 14 times, said Olson. Before coming to Indiana, the Delaware were moved to Ohio. Then in the late 1700s, there was an uprising of Native Americans in western Ohio who were against the settlers moving in. General Anthony Wayne, who Fort Wayne is named after, was sent to quell the tribal nations in that area.
The U.S. and really the settlers had a very poor view of the profile of the typical, what they would refer to as savages.
Olson says the U.S. government and some settlers saw these native tribes as less than human, when they themselves could be as equally savage when it came to managing the tribal groups. General Wayne wasn't an exception.
One of his approaches to battle with the indigenous peoples was to not just kill or decimate the males that were actually the warriors, but also to lay waste to the women and children and their home communities.
Olson says you could view Wayne's approach as a success in bringing the native tribes to their knees, not only with the Battle of Fallen Timbers, but
the indigenous nations had little choice but to enter into a treaty with them and with Wayne in 1794 at this Treaty of Greenville.
With nowhere to go, the Delaware came to Indiana. Jackson says it was thanks to the Miami.
You may come and live along our land along the White River.
Jackson said the Delaware were split into three clans, Turkey, Turtle, and Wolf. Clan chief for the Turkey clan was Chief Anderson. He chose the site that is now the city of Anderson. Anderson would later become the tribal chief, but the Delaware would soon be faced with another move as the U.S. government set their sights on the territory in Indiana.
Even though I think the United States kind of pacified itself with the belief that they were dealing with these indigenous nations on an equal footing through treaties, they really weren't.
In October of 1818, the Treaty of St. Mary's was signed, relinquishing all claims the tribes had to the lands in Indiana. Constantly being pushed from their lands, Olson says the tribes, even if they wanted to fight back, they didn't have the military power to really do so.
They became unable to militarily compete with this overriding, overarching, powerful American military.
So they began to think more politically about the best ways to manage the U.S. government and the settlers while keeping some of their land.
The tribal groups, particularly the Miami, decided that having individuals in leadership roles that understood the mindset of the Euro-Americans would be very important in their long-term survival.
Some of the best people in the tribes that could understand this mindset, the children born of mixed heritage. At first, Olson says these kids weren't granted leadership roles, but then it changed. He uses Jean-Baptiste Richardville as an example.
The Miami, and particularly Chief Richardville, was most successful in the political dynamics of dealing with the United States. But it was kind of like almost like a trying to make the best out of a bad situation.
For example, Jackson says Chief Anderson tried his best on keeping the peace between the Delaware and the U.S. government. In 1811, Anderson told Tecumseh, the Shawnee chief, no when he asked Anderson to commit his warriors to his confederation to throw the white man out of Indiana. He said no again during the War of 1812 when the Miami and others joined forces with British troops.
Chief Anderson was known as a peace-loving chief. Reason being, I think, is because he had been through the wars in western Ohio.
The Delaware would end up leaving Indiana, but
they've told me that they still consider this their homeland.
The tribe that held out the longest, the Miami. Olson says they were effective at keeping small amounts of land or reserves. Rayford backed the claim by saying several groups of Miami that had lived in Indiana for a long time wanted to stay, and Congress allowed some of the families to do so. He says the number of Miami that stayed after 1846, when the removal took place, was larger than the number of people who were taken west.
The Miami Nation of Indians of Indiana is very proud that this is called the Land of Indians. They really like that.
He says that having cities, towns, states named after Native Americans tells us they were here, and they're still here.
Two tribes have land in Indiana, land from the federal government. One is the Pokagon Band of Potawatomi. According to the state's website, the tribe got some land back in South Bend from their removal. That was in 2016. They now have a casino on that land, along with some housing and tribal government buildings.
The land is not subject to state jurisdiction. So it's land that exists within state boundaries or across state boundaries, but state law, state jurisdiction doesn't apply.
Bryce Obermeyer is a representative of the Delaware tribe who do not have land in the state, but he explains how Indian land and reservations are set aside.
And this is quite frankly why casinos can be established on reservations, because state laws that prohibit gaming don't apply on reservation land. This is also why, you know, you might have smoke shops or certain economic development that takes place on reservations, because it's outside of state jurisdiction, outside of state taxes, outside of state law.
The Miami tribe also has land in Indiana, in Fort Wayne, which is used for gatherings and ceremonies. But that's not the extent of Indiana's current Indian population. People who are members of tribes like the Sioux, Navajo, Comanche, Apache, Cherokee, and many of the 573 federally recognized tribes make up the 25,000 American Indians living in Indiana. You're listening to Indiana, Land of Indians. You're listening to Indiana, Land of Indians.
Madison County was formally organized on November the 10th, 1823. And it was in that same November of 1823 when a group of 10 Native Americans from a little town in Ohio called Lewistown arrived here to set up for the winter, to do hunting and get furs and so forth for trading and so forth.
The Fall Creek Massacre.
Three adult males, three adult females, and four children, two boys and two girls.
Madison County historian Steve Jackson says they were likely Seneca Indians, or perhaps Potawatomi. He says they camped in South Madison County, where some of the white settlers had some preconceived notions about Native people because of some previous violent interactions.
There was some confrontations that went on over maybe trading for things. There were arguments break out and so forth. So feelings over the winter were beginning to turn sour by the locals towards those 10 Native Americans that were settled or were encamped here in Madison County. And by the spring, March of 1824, that had turned into a rage, basically headed up by one individual, a man by the name of Thomas Harper, who riled up everybody in the area and said, we need to go and do something about those people.
Jackson says after a weekend of drinking, eight men started out on a Monday morning for the camp, armed with knives and rifles. One man lost his nerve and backed out. The group of 10 Indians had come to trust the people who came into the camp because they had traded with him. It was a betrayal. Jackson says the settlers asked the two Indian men who were at the camp to help them find two horses that had supposedly run off.
They'd gone a short distance when all of a sudden somebody leveled a rifle against the first Ludlow, I think it was, and he was shot and killed. That sound traveled to the forest and was the signal to the second group to kill the other Indian. So they did. Once the deed was done, those men returned to one of the cabins where they lived, which was on the north side of where the campsite was. And they decided, well, we need to go back and finish the job. So they went back to the campsite, and there were the three women and four children. And they proceeded to murder and butcher those seven individuals.
The people involved talked, and their neighbors alerted the sheriff, who found the camp, the massacred Indians, and arrested the group. Four people were indicted, three men and a teenager.
Each one had a trial. The first one was a man by the name of Hudson who was tried. He was convicted, and he was put in a jail there in Pendleton till he was sentenced to be hanged in November.
The man escaped, was caught, and his hanging was rescheduled for January.
The other three then were tried, all found guilty by a jury of their peers, all sentenced to be hung, and the date was set for June the 3rd, 1825.
While the two adults were hanged, the teenager was pardoned because of a petition from the other settlers. It was the first time under the United States Constitution that white men were executed for the murder of Indians. Jackson explains the rationale.
The United States government was afraid that the Indians might rise up if justice wasn't served. And so there was a lot of pressure put on the Indian agent to have the trial and have a fair trial and to execute, you know, if that was the decision of the jury, which it was.
Indians from all over Indiana and parts of Ohio and Michigan were brought to Pendleton, which was at that time the county seat of Madison County, to witness the hangings. The massacre and the executions are noted with both a stone memorial in Fall Creek Park in Pendleton and an historic marker along State Route 38 near where the massacre happened. And just because it happened that the law stood up for the native people in this instance doesn't mean it always happened that way. A commemoration that happens each year in Grant County happens partly so people will remember how some groups native to Indiana were hunted for siding with the British in the War of 1812.
American federal troops out of Ohio were sent on essentially a search and destroy mission.
Anthony Decker is president of the Mississinewa Battlefield Society.
To find Native Americans along the Mississinewa River that they had believed that were causing issues with allying with the British during the war, and essentially do a search and destroy and find them and attack them, which they did on December 17th.
And Mississinewa 1812 is a vivid and accurate reenactment of that battle.
We have over 1,000 reenactors that come in and demonstrate and set up a British camp, an American camp for on the military side. We have a Native American, a Eastern Woodland camp. We have a wilderness camp of settlers.
With the cannons and muskets and costumes, the event, which takes place this year on the first weekend of October, is a reminder of what life and death were like in a time of pioneers, a time when Native Americans were still ever present, and a time of war.
It's a really, really great opportunity to really get a feel for how intense and violent and also how respectful battle and war was, because there was a as much as violent as it was, there was also a gentleman code in battle and war back then, and we also display that.
Decker says that remembering the entire battle is important, but also remembering that one of the missions on December 17, 1812, was to seek out and destroy the Indians that may have sided with the British.
There was a counterattack by the Miami and Delaware Indians on the Mississinewa on December 18th. And even though it is not something to celebrate, it's a good piece of history to make sure we never forget and to then cherish the cultures that were here and speak for those that cannot speak anymore, both on the Native American side and the soldier side, and to keep the history alive.
Remembering the culture is taken literally at Mississinewa.
This year we have a brand new Delaware-style longhouse that we've been working on over the past 2 years, which is a really neat feature in the Native American camp. We have storytellers, Native American drum circles, a lot of Native American crafts going on, foods.
Remembering Indiana's Indian culture is also the mission of other events, like the Anderson Powwow.
The town of Anderson turns out, strong turnout, both young and old alike go over there to absorb what the Native Americans bring here.
The powwow has been going on since 2004, and Madison County historian Steve Jackson says the event brings value to the community in bringing both Native and non-Native people together.
What we're actually doing is we're actually snapping the little wooden stems right out of it. The actual string is in the bark area, and you can see once it's clean, you can actually see the strings that we can get from it.
Once again, there is a high respect, as I see it, for them, where they have demonstrations and so forth. They're well attended. There's a great interest, and the Delaware know that, and that's why they continue to come back here.
Jackson says many people who attend the powwow probably don't know or understand a lot about the history of Chief Anderson or the Indians who lived in the area because much of it is not taught in schools. He says teaching the kids about the Native Americans who lived and live in Indiana is a good idea, and he's glad that some teachers in his part of the state ask him to come to the classrooms and share his knowledge.
I've had local teachers here in Anderson contact me and ask me to come to the school and put on programs for their children to give them some flavor of what local history has to offer as far as Native Americans. As the teachers have told me, they have to go by the materials that they're given in order to teach, and most of the materials that they have about Native Americans, they talk about the Native Americans that greeted the Pilgrims.
Coming up, the difference between the history and the present.
The big story was encroachment and people just illegally taking resources and illegally taking land.
And why team names like Redskins could soon be a part of the past.
And they made up a mascot called Injun Andy, I-N-J-U-N. A very bad image of American Indians.
You're listening to Indiana, Land of Indians. The origin story of the Miami Indians of Indiana says they came out of the water near the mouth of the St. Joseph River near South Bend. According to that oral history, the Miami are the only Indian tribe in the state that has a story of origin that originates here. But even though the Miami have a kinship with the land and water of Indiana, they do not have the federal recognition that they once had. The federal recognition of the tribe was lost to an opinion by the Undersecretary of the Interior in 1897. Since then, the tribe has been seeking to regain that recognition and that status.
Federally recognized tribes are sovereign nations, and so when the United States deals with countries like Brazil or Mexico or Germany, they're dealing with sovereign nations, and the same thing is true when the United States deals with Indian tribes.
Bryce Obermeyer, a tribal representative of the Delaware Indians, explains what that recognition would mean.
The citizens of tribal nations have political citizenship citizenship in a sovereign nation as opposed to simply having Native American descent or heritage.
The Miami now exist in Indiana as a nonprofit. They have a principal chief and tribal government. But Congress has consistently refused federal recognition, which they seek. Obermeyer says, like the Miami, the Delaware had their land taken away little by little before the large removal by settlers who came here illegally, settled on Indian land, and stayed, despite petitions from the Indians who by treaty had the land.
I think that incrementalism is something that we don't often get taught or don't often understand. We think of removal as maybe involving the military or involving some kind of forced removal, but in fact, for the Delawares and many tribes from the Midwest, the Shawnees would be included, the Miamis would be included. The big story was encroachment and people just illegally taking resources and illegally taking land. And when it got too much, the federal government tried to make it better through treaty agreements in which the tribes agreed to move west of the Mississippi River.
That has helped lead to a history of mistrust between Indian tribes and the federal government. But Indian tribes have also had issues with state government.
Indiana is probably kind of behind many states in their efforts on tribal consultation. That's not unusual for states that don't have federally recognized tribes within their boundaries. Things like the Department of Transportation and different state agencies are not as active in maintaining a relationship, at least with the Delaware tribe.
But Obermeyer does give credit where it's due.
I think in terms of honoring, you know, the legacy, the heritage of the Delaware heritage in along the White River, I think the relationship between the Delaware tribe and Indiana is quite strong and quite positive.
But what about the relationship between Indian names, perceptions, and characteristics when it comes to mascots? Indiana's name comes from its inhabitants, a name the state has had since 1800.
It can be touchy because the Indiana State Fair, this was years ago, wanted to advertise, you know, Indiana's a land of Indians.
Historian Stuart Rayford.
And they made up a mascot called Injun Andy, I-N-J-U-N. A very bad image of American Indians. And Ray White of the Miami went down and talked to state fair officials. He said, look, this is not working. It's really offensive. And they removed that immediately. I would say in most cases that the naming of things really should be checked with the Indian groups that are concerned, like this gentleman from the Delaware tribe, to see how they feel about it.
An assortment of names, past and present, gives Miami Chief Brian Buchanan cause to say it's not okay.
Well, several names have stuck. Savage has stuck, and we've still got mascots here in the state of Indiana. I think we've got squaws used a couple of times. We've got Redskins. You know, there's a lot of things that history's done to demean the Native American people in general, not just the Miamis. What we choose to fight and try to correct, we have to pick our battles. We have to pick the ones we know we can win. Because just because it's immorally incorrect doesn't mean we're going to win.
And now that the Cleveland Indians have a name change in store for the next season to become the Guardians, Eric Berman talks with the Indianapolis Indians about the past, present, and future of their team name.
Three different pro teams in the 1880s and 90s called themselves the Indianapolis Hoosiers. As early as 1895, when the Hoosiers won the Western League, the team was switching between calling itself the Hoosiers and the Indians. The Western League changed its name to the American League, and in 1901 proclaimed itself a major league, whereupon it cut loose Indianapolis and three other cities. Indy joined the newly formed American Association in 1902 as the Indians and has had the name ever since. Team CEO Bruce Schumacher says it didn't really have anything to do with Native Americans. It was a play on words, like the Philadelphia Phillies.
We live in a city that's called City of Indians and a state that's called Land of Indians. I think it's as simple as coming from that, quite honestly.
While the Indians may not have been named for the Indians, the team has made use of the marketing possibilities. As with the Major League Indians in Cleveland, headline writers have sometimes called the team the Tribe. The team has sometimes used that name itself. The Indians' quilt logo and the players' caps depict a Native American wearing face paint. And at Old Bush Stadium, there used to be a teepee beyond the outfield wall.
We found out, however many years ago it was, that the teepee was actually not used by Indians in this part of the country. It used by Indians in some parts of the country, but not in central Indiana. They actually used bark houses. houses. So we thought, well, if it's not historically accurate, maybe we don't need to use it anymore.
Schumacher likes to point out the Indianapolis team has been the Indians longer than the Cleveland team has. Cleveland was the Naps in honor of Hall of Famer Nap Lajoie until he left for the A's in 1915. The Cleveland Indians bought their namesake team in 1951. Rocky Colavito and Roger Maris were among those who played in Indy during its 5 years as Cleveland's top farm team. The Indians' controversial Chief Wahoo mascot was part of the connection.
We stopped using that and we stopped working with them. So I think through the years we've tried to be conscious of doing things the right way and respectfully.
Cleveland has announced this will be its last season as the Indians. Schumacher says while there have been occasional questions about the name over the years, it didn't really become a serious topic of discussion until last year when the NFL's Washington Redskins announced they'd change their name. The Indians formed a committee to look at the name.
It's something that we get questions on from time to time. We have tried to reach out to Native American groups and other stakeholders to get their sense about the name, and that's something that as time goes by we'll continue to study.
But Schumacher says there's no timetable for that review. The team has had other issues to deal with.
You know, this has been a tough 20 months for us. Until we got going again in May, we hadn't played baseball since August of 2019. So just trying to hang in there and keep our staff together and be able to open up. Kind of been a lot on our plate the last year and a half.
But it's not just baseball, and it's not just Indianapolis.
We have here our local high school is called the Anderson Indians, and we have the high school has an Indian mascot and a maiden, and during the basketball pregame ceremony, both come out and they do a dance and so forth, and it riles and gets the crowd all stirred up for the game.
Steve Jackson, Madison County historian.
I brought this up to the three chiefs, former chiefs, that were here one day for the powwow, and we were sitting down in a tent, and they said, as long as it's done with respect, which they said Anderson High School does that, we have no problem with that. In fact, they said, we are honored that they remember us this way.
But some team names and mascots go beyond the word Indian and, like the Chief Wahoo cartoon, seem less respectful.
Do you want to be called Blackskins? Do you want to be called Yellowskins? No, it's not right.
Miami Chief Brian Buchanan on Public Access TV in Fort Wayne.
So when will the morality of society come to the level of saying it's not right? Let them fix it on their own. We did put it out there. They already know how we feel about it. But I'm not going to fight them on.
And what about the root word Indian in Indians? Is it bad nomenclature?
A Hopi woman told me, she said, you know, this question of whether we're Indian or Native American, we like to be called who we are. If we're out on the reservation, we like to have our tribal name used, like Apache or whatever. And if we're in the cities, Native American works nicely because, you know, with a whole bunch of different tribal people. And she said, it's one of those things that white people worry about, but we don't worry about that very much.
Historian Andy Olson.
And in some respects, I think it is a credit to our culture that we are, in fact, trying to right that wrong among those of us that have an interest in this type of thing by trying to provide a more accurate, even-keeled view of what the relationships and the situations were.
You've been listening to Indiana, Land of Indians, written and produced by Chris Davis, Madison McGill, and Eric Berman. Special thanks to Bryce Obermeyer, Stuart Rayford, Steve Jackson, and Andy Olson.